This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about what it will take to ensure the climate crisis gets the attention it deserves in 2024 election coverage and how important this is for voters. A new report, Climate Change Opinion and Recent Presidential Elections, by the University of Colorado Boulder's Center for Social and Environmental Futures, shows that between the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections, climate change became very important to voters. Climate voters strongly preferred Democrats, and climate change probably cost Donald Trump the 2020 election, according to the study. If these trends continue, climate change could provide Democrats with an even larger electoral advantage in 2024. Joining us is the study's co-author, Matt Burgess, an assistant professor in environmental studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for joining us. Hi, do we have Matt?
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hi, nice to have you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Nathaniel Stinnett, founder and executive director of the Environmental Voter Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit that identifies millions of non-voting environmentalists and turns them into consistent voters. They estimate that over 8 million environmentalists did not vote in the 2020 presidential election, and over 13 million skipped the 2022 midterms. They are trying to turn that around. Hi, Nathaniel. Thank you so much for your work, and thanks for joining us again.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have both of you. This is such an important issue. Matt, let's start off with you and talk about the study that you co-authored. It found that fewer than 5% of voters see climate change as the single most important issue facing Americans. Now, I have to say, we've been covering climate issues regularly every Monday since the 2016 election. And so we're wondering, do you think more people would care about the climate crisis if it actually got the media attention it deserves?
Well, that's a good question. First of all, the poll you cited is not from our study. It's from Gallup, which we mentioned in our study. And importantly, that poll says that only 5% of voters say climate change is their single most important issue. But if you look at several different polls, including the one that we mainly analyzed for our study, it's about two-thirds of voters that think climate change is important and want something done about it. So, but there is an interesting contrast there, right? If voters don't say climate change is their top issue, why do we see statistically in the data an effect of voting on climate? In terms of your question about whether the media covering it more would help, I think that's actually a complicated question. Certainly, the more the media covers something, the more it gets attention. But I think that the media has maybe less of a persuasion ability than it sometimes thinks it does. And I think one of the things we're seeing with declining trust in media and universities recently is we have to be careful to stick to being honest brokers of the facts as much as we can, to avoid preaching to the choir and talking to only within our echo chambers. But that's just my personal take.
Well, and also media these days, that means a lot of different things. I mean, we usually talk about major media, but people are in silos now. People get news from outlets or people we've never heard of. So we're living in a very different world when it comes to media.
Absolutely, that's right. And that's one of the big challenges of our time in terms of political polarization. And political polarization is a huge issue for climate change. You know, if we're serious about changing all of society over decades, I just don't see how that's possible in a democracy without both parties working together. And so our three options, if you think about it, are do it together, don't do it, or undo it every 4 years and redo it, or wreck democracy and hope the dictator's a climate hawk. And history suggests dictators usually are not climate hawks. So I really hope they will choose the first option.
What are your thoughts on this, Nathaniel? I mean, to learn, according to your research at the Environmental Voter Project, that 13 million environmentalists, people who care about the environment, do not vote in federal elections. What explains that? And do you think if these issues got more attention, we'd see more environmentalists voting?
Yeah, so I think this highlights another really important axis on which to view these issues. So you and Matt alluded to the difference between issue preferences and issue priorities. So lots of people would prefer government action on climate change, but not necessarily many Americans list it as a number one priority. I think another really important axis on which to view public opinion about climate is voters versus non-voters. I mean, whether you vote or not is public record in the United States. And if you are running a political campaign, believe me, you care a lot less about the opinions of non-voters than you do about the opinions of voters. And right now, those of us in the climate movement are leaving a lot of political power on the sidelines. And you asked why that's the case, Rose. And there's a lot that we don't know, but there is some that we do know. First, people who care deeply about climate and the environment are disproportionately young and disproportionately people of color. And so one of the reasons so many people who care deeply about climate and the environment aren't voting is that they are the object of voter suppression efforts. If anybody anywhere is trying to make it harder for someone to vote, chances are they're targeting either young people or people of color. Right. But the second thing, to get to your other point, does some of it have to do with media coverage? I think so. But as Matt alluded to, this is a really nuanced question. And I tend to think where media coverage tends to kind of not tell the most salient parts of the story here is how the climate crisis is impacting individuals within their communities. We see in polling data over and over again that when climate disasters strike, surprise, surprise, people in that area care a whole lot more about climate change. But if you're not making those connections between the climate crisis and what's happening in your neighborhood, it's really hard for people to do it on their own.
Did you want to jump in, Matt?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and just say, you know, one thing that I also think is really interesting and important and not a lot of people know is some of those hidden climate voters that Nathaniel were talking about are moderate and young Republicans. So, you know, majorities of moderate and young Republicans want action. One of the things we study in my group is political polarization of climate change. And I like, one of the things I like to say is the divide is not between left and right anymore. It's really between the hard right and everybody else. One of my favorite statistics on this is that a majority of voters in both Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene's district think Congress isn't doing enough to address global warming. So there really is a hidden bipartisanship among voters that we could tap into.
I think this is so important. Can you elaborate on that? Because we need to go beyond the Congress is broken line, which we hear in the media on a daily basis. Because as you say, when you dig deeper than just the Marjorie Taylor Greens, when you look at the people who actually live in these districts, they actually want something to be done about the climate crisis and many other issues. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure, yeah. So majorities of young and moderate Republicans want something done and want the government to be part of the solution for climate change. And, you know, as you go down from the top of the ticket, there's actually already lots of signs of cooperation, even among some legislators. So, for example, there are about 80 congressional Republicans in the House that are part of the Conservative Climate Caucus. It's one of the largest caucuses in the House of Representatives right now, started by John Curtis, a Republican of Utah. We did a study a couple of years ago that found that there have been over 100 bipartisan climate bills passed at the state level. Even at the federal level, if you look at the CHIPS and Science Act, that was bipartisan. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act was bipartisan. The COVID relief bill before that had a lot of climate spending in it was bipartisan. Even the Inflation Reduction Act, which was not bipartisan, had some elements in it that my colleagues and I wrote about how they were similar to some elements that have been passed at the state level by Republican and bipartisan groups. So there, I think that we're getting there. If you look even in the presidential primary, Nikki Haley, who, you know, came in second, talked about climate change and talked about how she thought that the government should be working to address it. Now, there are disagreements still among climate conscious Republicans and Democrats about what to do and how to do it. But I think that the voters clearly want a bipartisan conversation, and we are slowly getting there in terms of the politicians too.
We're going to talk in a minute about what would actually happen under a Trump administration and then also what has happened under Biden. But before we do that, Nathaniel, can you talk about what the Environmental Voter Project is doing right now? I mean, you're already out in the country trying to ensure that environmentalists go to the polls in November.
That's exactly right. We at the Environmental Voter Project think it's important to realize that the climate movement doesn't have enough political power, period. Politicians would be a lot more responsive to these desires and preferences that Matt was referring to if we had more political power. And a lot of that has to do with so few climate-first Americans showing up to vote. So there are two ways that you could address that. One, you could try to convince more voters to care deeply about climate. But that's hard. Getting people to change their minds is really hard and really expensive. Or two, you could find people who already care deeply about climate yet aren't voting and mobilize them to vote. And that's what we do. And so we're active in 19 states across the country. We work with thousands of volunteers to canvass and call and mail and send digital ads to, we've actually identified 4.8 million registered voters in 19 states who are unlikely to vote this fall if they're not pushed to do so. And so those are the almost 5 million people we're concentrating on over the next 8 months. And again, it's completely nonpartisan. We're just trying to encourage these people to show up because we know that politicians don't care about non-voters. They care about voters. And so those of us who care about climate change need to show up and cast ballots, not just in the fall, but this spring and next year and the year after that. We try to build habitual climate voters.
Nathaniel Stinnett is founder and executive director of the Environmental Voter Project. They found that 13 million people who care about the planet skipped the 2022 midterms. They are trying to turn that around. We're also joined by Matt Burgess, assistant professor in environmental studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's co-author of a new report, Climate Change Opinion and Recent Presidential Elections. It found between the 2016 and 2020 elections, climate change became increasingly important to voters. We have about 5 minutes left, so let's talk about what's really at stake here. I mean, we cannot say this enough. Climate scientists say we have to enact real change by 2030. It's not like we've got 50 more years on the table, so if we go back and forth, it's all good. I mean, really, the next president has to enact real change in order to turn this around. Matt, in a piece for The Conversation, you write, while in office, Donald Trump rolled back 125 environmental rules and policies aimed at protecting the country's air, water, land, and wildlife. Biden restored many of those regulations. We've been talking about Project 2025, which is basically a blueprint if Trump is elected again. And I'm just reading now from Scientific American. Trump's second term could begin with a clear direction on climate policy. Trash it. He's starting his speeches with drill, baby, drill. He's going to replace White House climate advisors with an advisor who would serve the needs of the fossil fuel industry. Many say that it's going to be even worse this time around than last time. So can you talk about what's really at stake in this upcoming election?
Well, I'm a Canadian public university professor, so I'm not going to tell anybody who to vote for. But what I can tell you is that while it's true that former President Trump is one of the most anti-climate policy Republicans, it's also true that, you know, even if he's elected, the White House doesn't act in a vacuum. So Politico, for example, had a recent report that talked about how some of the extreme policies that you describe in that 2025 document are likely to face opposition from congressional Republicans. An example of that from last time is some of the science funding, climate science funding, in each White House budget request was reduced significantly when Trump was in power. But then, as I believe it's the case, that climate science funding eventually increased under Congress. And some of that had to do with Republicans in Congress, including here in Colorado. We have a Senator, Cory Gardner, who have a lot of science funding in their district. The economics of addressing climate change are becoming more and more unstoppable. So do you want to know who represents the district in the United States with the second most planned and operational renewable energy capacity in the country? Kevin McCarthy. So if you look at a state like Wyoming, that is one of the reddest states in the country with lots of fossil fuels, they also have lots of wind power, lots of carbon capture. They just found a huge deposit of rare earth minerals that that is key to electrifying and other aspects of the energy transition. Also, American businesses benefit if we're ahead of the curve in terms of developing new technologies that are going to address the issue, because then we get to export those technologies abroad. So what I would say is that, you know, while any voter should look, including climate voters, should look at the two parties and make the decision about what they think is best for their views, I would also say, you know, to conservatives that, you know, addressing climate change really is consistent with American greatness and American exceptionalism, right? Who better than us to lead the world in this new clean energy economy that's going to come whether we like it or not?
Nathaniel, what would you add?
I think I'd say two things. One, Matt is undoubtedly right that there are many red districts, in fact, maybe a predominance of red districts, who are gaining an enormous amount from the growth of the clean energy economy. But I think it's important to recognize that it was blue state politicians voting for the Inflation Reduction Act that created the economic incentives to allow those red districts to get all of that business. And so, although people on both sides of the aisle are reaping the rewards of aggressive climate policies, that doesn't mean that they both consistently push for it. And the second thing I would say is that it is far, far too late in the game for us to take any solace in the fact that if the next 4 years are awful, well, maybe we'll be able to go back the 4 years after that. Because the truth is, I mean, any objective observer, I think, can say that Joe Biden's climate legislative wins have probably been bigger than any climate laws ever passed in the United States. Yet, that same objective observer has to admit that even those climate policies, even those climate wins, aren't moving as fast as science demands. And so we cannot afford to have the next 4 years even be in neutral, let alone going backwards, because even with all of Joe Biden's climate victories, we're still not moving as fast as science demands. Mm. And so, yeah, the next 7.5 months leading up, not just to the presidential election, but state legislative elections and gubernatorials and congressional and Senate races are so, so important for the climate movement. Because if we don't elect a whole lot of climate leaders, the next 4 years aren't going to be close to what we need. Mm.
Yes, and let's hope that this issue and what you just laid out there gets more attention in the major media as we head into this election. Well, it's now getting 24/7 coverage, but we do have many months left. Nathaniel Stinnett is founder and executive director of the Environmental Voter Project. Matt Burgess is assistant professor in environmental studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, and you can find out more about their work at yourcallradio.org. Nathaniel and Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls One Planet series.